Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we welcome back Lori Shapiro for part two of the discussion on Carl Jung's psychological theory, The Personal Shadow. We also hear a short interview with Jordan Page, a young singer-songwriter with a powerful message. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. Energy firm caught breaking down door to install smart meter. Smart meters are a financial Trojan horse for big energy. This is why we're witnessing, and now catching on film, criminal acts of vandalism, breaking and entering and trespass by energy firms trying to install their next generation cash machines in the homes of customers. When energy companies are prepared to treat the personal property of customers with such abject disrespect, the extent to which they will care for highly sensitive personal data is in no doubt. A one-year study in Toronto by Toronto Hydro showed that 80% of people's bills increase after smart meters are installed. Quote, dozens and dozens of customers are reporting some billing spikes, in one case more than 1,000%, reported a Canadian consumer affairs reporter, Linda Steele. In the UK, they received reports of bills doubling and tripling after smart meters have been installed, with one small business owner in London nearly being put out of business. Big energy firms are publicly listed for-profit enterprises, answerable to their shareholders. If you are left with any uncertainty about whose agenda smart meters are designed to serve, we encourage you to watch Josh DeSaul's critical investigation of the smart metering and smart grid phenomena. It's a film titled Take Back Your Power. It premieres this month. You might not have heard much about this event, the Global March Against Geoengineering. But handfuls of people around the country and around the world gathered together to protest and demonstrate in the streets against the spraying of our skies and the manipulation of the weather using geoengineering. I met up with Cindy and Jim Pakulis of Long Island Skywatch and others, and we went to an event where a young singer-songwriter was performing. His name is Jordan Page. His music is very impactful. I got to hear it for the first time. I sat down with him for a quick interview. Let's have a listen.
My name is Jordan Page. I am a singer-songwriter, guitar player, and I travel all over the country singing songs about the things that are going on in the world and in the country. Very liberty based music. It's not God Bless America music, it's Wake Up America music. And I'm just kind of using my skills as a songwriter and a musician and to reflect the things that I'm feeling, the things that I'm seeing, the dangerous trends that our country is taking and the dark road that we're heading down. Right now I'm on tour in New England. This is the last night of my 10-day tour. I'm here in Long Island and we're having a great time. Pendulum was an interesting song that just kind of came to me like in the middle of the night out of a dream back in December of 2006. And I felt like it was very much a kind of a message from above that I was supposed to learn what's going on. And I spent about a year and a half really digging deep and reading a lot of books, watching a lot of documentaries, talking to a lot of people, and putting two and two together, connecting the dots about how wars are started, who benefits from them, connecting, you know, the Department of Defense to the Federal Reserve, to the, you know, the international banking cartels, to the media, to, you know, perpetuating lies. You know, I mean, all the major news outlets in this country are owned by a handful of corporations that have a vice grip on truth and, you know, aren't letting it go anytime soon. And they're the ones that convince us that we should give up our liberties for this imaginary illusion of safety. And I think for good reason that there are, that most of the reasons that we are involved in all these conflicts are based on complete lies. Every war we're engaged in right now is completely illegal, undeclared by Congress, unconstitutional, and immoral. And I'm seeking to mobilize an active resistance in the people of this country through education and inspiration through music to become conscious of this too. I would categorize the liberty-minded movement in this country as a consciousness movement, and I'm grateful to be part of that. So regardless of what we believe, we don't have to agree on everything, but we all agree that we want to be free. There's a very fringe element in this country that does not want to be free, and does not want others to be free. But unfortunately, they're the ones in control. There's about 535 of them in Washington, D.C. who don't want us to be free. And what I'm interested in is starting conversations, planting seeds, getting people talking about what's going on, and you know, getting people excited that they have an opportunity to affect change in their own lives, whereas I think most people feel disillusioned and isolated from their destinies, because most people are just stuck in these jobs as wage slaves, and they're just wrapped up in taking care of their sustenance needs and taking care of their families. They don't engage in any kind of activity that would help to free them from the chains of bondage that they suffer from. And you know, music is a very non-threatening way to get a message across to people, a very non-threatening and subliminal sometimes way to get through. My lyrics are not so subliminal, but hopefully the music itself is appealing enough to reach them, to give it a chance and let it in. But many people hear the music, they like the music, then they realize what the words mean, and they have an allergic reaction to it, and their heads explode. So we can't save everybody. You know, Jesus couldn't save everybody, neither can I. You know, and I'm hoping to follow in his footsteps and liberate people with a different way of looking at the world that doesn't include, you know, systems of control regulating every aspect of our lives. I want to be left alone. I want you to be left alone. And hopefully we're going to make government obsolete in the future and move to a voluntarist society where we interact with each other by using the non-aggression principle, adhering to self-ownership, where I own myself and you own yourself, and no one can tell you what you can do with you.
We're in a really interesting spot right now with the aerosol operations, and this is why a lot of us are meeting here tonight. It's the Global March Against Geoengineering. When did you find out about these operations, and what is your response to it?
I found out about geoengineering and chemtrails back in 2007. I reacted with a bit of incredulity and disbelief, and finally, I went through the five stages of grief with that one. It is a despicable practice that's being perpetrated upon the entire world. Every human being in the world is being subjected to these toxic chemicals being sprayed in the air. All you need to do is look up in the sky, and you can see that they're not contrails. They're not clouds. They're chemicals, and there's a mountain of evidence, definitive evidence to prove this. A good friend of mine is a whistleblower on this issue, and she's traveling the country waking people up too. Her name's Kristen Megan, and she's a very brave woman. And I'm very proud of her for exposing the truth. She was a high-ranking official on an Air Force base for many years, and cataloged a tremendous amount of aerosol chemicals coming into the base and then leaving the canisters leaving empty. And she's been blowing the whistle on chemtrails for a long time now. There's some great films called like What in the World Are They Spraying? There's actually a lot of films, a lot of books that people can. All you have to do is just Google chemtrails and you can find out. But I think there's a lot of theories about why they're spraying chemtrails. The latest one I heard was it had to do with the elitist idea that they want to turn everyone into cyborgs, like transhumanism essentially. There's a disease actually called Morgellon syndrome, where people develop these open sores and plastic polyfiber tissue comes out of the sores, and it's not natural tissue, it doesn't occur in nature. It's actually plastic type material, and the people who have been researching this have found that everyone has these tissues in them, that everyone has these tiny, you know, micro nanobot particles in their tissue, but that some people are genetically predisposed to reject the fibers that come out of this process, and those people get Morgellons disease. I just heard about this. I'm not sure where I stand with that. It's just the latest theory that I've heard about why they're doing it. Either way, they're poisoning the water, they're poisoning the soil, they're poisoning the air. Aluminum is a known neurotoxin. Aluminum is one of the main gases they're spraying. And it's a known neurotoxin, known to cause autism, known to cause Alzheimer's, cancer, a whole slew of diseases. And it's just a very disturbing trend.
Somebody just told me that one of your songs answers Bob Dylan's question in one of his songs.
That's Pendulum, yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that song and what are you answering?
Well, I didn't realize it at the time, but you know, the verses in my song Pendulum seem to be the answers to the questions in Bob Dylan's song A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And I realized that I was playing it for Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, who's become a good friend, and he informed me that Bob Dylan was inspired by a 15th century folk song called Randall, My Son, that is also a question and answer kind of song. Where have you been, Randall, my son? And he played the song for me once, and it was just really interesting to see how a song written in the 21st century was influenced by a song from the early 1960s, which was influenced by a song from the 1500s. And this, you know, amazing, famous icon of the civil rights movement was singing it for me and helped me to make that connection. But the song itself is talking, it's about everything. It's about the Federal Reserve. It's about Ron Paul. It's about the rising police state. It's about the erosion of our liberties in America. It's about the media spreading lies and perpetuating war through those lies. It's about a spiritual revolution of the individual and people just standing up and taking ownership of themselves.
What do you see the spiritual fight that people are under right now?
I think we're being bombarded with so much negative media, so much hedonistic information, and we're not being taught what it's really all about. I think that the reason the Constitution has failed is because we have become an immoral people. The Constitution can only work for immoral people, and you know, I see the younger generations coming up, and they're not being guided, they're not being guarded, they're not being taught how to be good people. They're a lot of them are running wild. I'm a father of four young children, and I see, I'm around other kids all the time, and I see what's happening. And you know, I'm a very spiritual person. I walk a very close relationship with God and with Jesus Christ. But I find myself at odds with most Christians these days. I think that they've lost the true meaning of what Jesus was doing here and what he was saying, what he was teaching us. And I'm just I'm part of my mission, I would call it, is to shed light on that and to bring his message back from a common sense approach, and not bashing people over the head and telling them that because of what they believe that they're going to suffer eternal punishment, which of which there's no evidence for.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
That was an interview with Jordan Page. Let's hear one of his songs. It's titled Listen.
Listen to the sound that you hear, like it echoing your head. There's a strange vibration rising now from the heart of America, America. Listen to the sound of a drum calling players to the game of the new. Listen to the
This is part two of the Shadow Project with Lori Shapira, a teacher at the C.G. Young Institute of New York and president of its board of directors. She's a filmmaker and author of the book The Cassandra Complex, Living with Disbelief, A Modern Perspective on Hysteria. She also wrote, directed, and produced a film titled The Prophecy of the Seeress. Carl Jung's concept of the shadow seems to underlie the nature of this dark time we're living in, where war and greed is rampant, food and water is poison, and lies about all of these things proliferate. Carl Jung was a Swiss psychotherapist and psychiatrist, and the founder of analytical psychology. In 1917, he wrote in his essay, quote, On the Psychology of Unconscious, about the personal shadow as the other in us. The negative side of the personality, the sum of all unpleasant qualities we like to hide. It embarrasses or shames us. Everything with a substance casts a shadow. The ego stands to the shadow as light to shade. In this second interview with Lori Shapira, we also look at the timelessness of the human shadow in popular films that sometimes depicts a character making a transformation by absorbing the shadow. Lori Shapira, welcome back to In Other News.
Hi, Jeff. It's good to be back with you.
Well, this is part two of The Shadow Project. And before we begin, can you remind listeners a little bit more of the structures of Jung's psychological concept of the shadow and projection?
Sure. The shadow is that part of the personality that the individual doesn't realize is part of them, is part of who they are. Jung's concept of the structure of the psyche, there's ego consciousness, and then fairly close to that is personal shadow, the parts of you that are you, but you're not aware that it's you. Then there's a collective shadow, which is more archetypal. It relates to the whole culture. Then there's the animus and anima. The animus is the soul image, masculine soul image of a woman, and the anima is the feminine soul image of a man. And then all of this is comprised under the self, the larger personality.
We're going to be talking about projection, positive projections and negative projections. Can you remind listeners what is the concept of projection?
Sure. People tend to project parts of themselves onto other people or other things. The shadow is very often projected because it's a part of yourself that you don't want to acknowledge, and how easy it is to see it in other people, not see it in yourself. In working with the shadow, we were talking about that last time. We were talking about how the shadow operates and how does one work with the shadow. If a piece of shadow is in projection, what's crucial is that you are able to see that it's actually part of yourself. So what's very important is that one introspects. We need to reflect on ourselves and see that we are actually projecting our shadow onto the outside world. If we have a very strong reaction to someone or something, a strong emotional reaction like anger or fear or even some kind of fascination, one needs to take time out and say, okay, well, why am I so angry at this person? That's assuming that they haven't done something to you that would make you objectively angry. But this would be more of a sort of subjective anger that doesn't actually really make sense why you would have such a strong reaction to it. So one has to take a step away and look into one's own self and say, is this possibly something in me? How am I like that person?
Lori Shapira, you're a Jungian analyst. Can you tell listeners what that is exactly and what qualifies you to be one?
To be a Jungian analyst, you have to train in a Jungian analytic training program. There are training programs all over the world. Depending on the training program and what their requirements are for entrance, some require that you already have a degree that enables you to practice psychotherapy and experience as a psychotherapist. Some training programs don't require that. Our training program, we take students who are already professional psychotherapists, but we also take people who don't have a degree per se. They need to have a master's degree in something, and they need to show that they have an interest in deep psychology, and they need to have some therapy. But we don't require that they have that they already are practicing psychotherapists. But during the course of the training process, they will learn how to become psychotherapists, Jungian analysts in particular. They'll take courses in psychodynamics and in also in mythology, because that's one of the hallmarks of Jungian psychology, as Jung was interested in the archetypes of the collective unconscious and saw patterns of behavior corresponding with cross-cultural myths. So that's another course of study, and of course reading Jung and Neo-Jungians. The training is quite intense and rather lengthy. It's usually 5 to 7 years of training. It's part-time training, but it's quite intense. And one of the most important pieces of the training is one's own personal process, that you're in your own Jungian analysis throughout that time. And that is probably the most important learning tool.
Do you mean of yourself?
Yes, your own process.
So that implies learning to recognize your own shadow aspects.
Absolutely.
Lori, I was looking at this book, Developing Psychic Skills. It's just something I picked up in a secondhand store. And I hadn't read it, but I opened it up, and what caught my eye is a short piece on archetypes and Carl Jung. I wrote some of it out, because to me it might be significant here. And it's talking about the world of the Oversoul containing many levels. One level is called the Underworld. It's where the mythological figures reside in the universal consciousness. These mythic figures, such as gods and goddesses, have been created by humankind as a sort of group projection or mass thought form. They exist for us in the underworld, and even though our conscious selves might not have experienced them, our higher selves know them well. Here also, our archetypes, what psychiatrist C.G. Jung described as thought forms or ideas, derived from the collective experience of a racial group which reside in the individual unconscious. We respond to these unconscious archetypes or symbols whether or not we recognize their existence. And often they form the basis of our expectations. That's very interesting. For example, Western society's collective experience of God instills in each Western individual an archetypal God against which any personal experience is measured. The same is true for archetypes such as a mother, father, man, woman, etc. Are there techniques for recognizing some of the symbolic beings who reside in your personal unconscious, in your underworld?
Interesting that you bring in tarot cards, because I often use the metaphor of that we're each of us dealt a hand of cards, a set of archetypes that are operating within us. And in the course of a Jungian analysis, one of the things that you're going to discover through dream work is what those archetypes are. How to know if you're not in Jungian analysis, and not all of us are in a position to be in Jungian analysis, how can one know? Well, I think it'd be tricky unless you are studying some symbol system like tarot cards or astrology. If there's something you're attracted to, there's a myth that you've heard or a story that you've heard, a fairy tale that you know, that you feel a kinship with. That's one way to find out. If you see a painting and you're just really attracted to it, there's a kind of gut reaction, a kind of emotional reaction to some archetypal image, you can be pretty sure that archetype is relevant to you. And then the thing to do is to research it, Google it, find out what it is, find out what the storyline is, because that's really relevant to our personalities, is that we're running these stories. And we don't realize that we're running these stories. And it's very helpful to find out what story you're compelled and impelled to live out. The consciousness of it. You may not ever be able to unhook yourself from it because it's in your bones. But perhaps you can, by understanding what the storyline, what the plot line is, you might be able to see that you're acting it out.
In our last interview, we scratched the surface of the shadow archetype portrayed in films. And as you pointed out, these are timeless stories, classic characters, and some of these films deal with the shadow and the underworld, and individually using treasure in these dark moments and transforming them into something valuable. There's an endless content, it seems, of underworld archetypes depicting the dark side of success, power, and achieving competence through absorbing the shadow. We went through a few films that we can talk about. The horror classics have a lot of these structures in them. Batman, Avatar, Spider-Man 3, The Matrix, and on and on. But let's pick one, for example.
I vote for Avatar.
We're speaking with Lori Shapira about the psychological concept of the personal shadow. We'll be right back after this break. Just tuning in, we're speaking with Lori Shapira about Carl Jung's psychological theory on the human shadow.
Let's talk about Avatar. What I got from this, and this might be different from what you are looking at, but it seemed to me another example of a transformation, doing what you can't do or couldn't do in conscious life, and then reborn into a consciousness of an avatar. There's an underworld and shadow aspect, but can you talk about what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really taken by that film. The shadow play in that film is really multidimensional, because that main character, Jake Sully, which is, I think, is an interesting name, Sully, as a verb means dirtied, and the shadow is often thought of as something dirty. So Jake is already living in his shadow, in the sense that he's an ex-Marine paraplegic. So he has is suffering the loss of his own heroic persona. So he's already living in his shadow, and he's given this opportunity to inhabit an avatar, which is this created body for him to inhabit. The idea being that he will then be sent down to this planet Pandora among these indigenous people called the Navi people to mine this stuff called unobtainium. Western civilization acting out their greedy impulse to exploit other places. When Jake takes on the avatar and goes down to the planet, he discovers that these people, these Navi people, who are considered to be inferiors to the humans, they're more primitive, so-called, and what he finds is that they really are quite superior. So there's this fluid shadow thing that goes on. I mean, he experiences the shadow people as much more pleasant than the human world. And this film is, I feel like there's a new ethos in film characters. Typically, fiction films have a protagonist and an antagonist. The protagonist represents ego consciousness, and the antagonist represents the shadow. A central archetypal image of the ego is the hero. Traditionally, the heroic ego conquers the shadow. The good guy kills the bad guy, the evildoer. It's cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians, the Allied forces versus the Nazis. Good wins out in the end. But we saw a shift in this motif in the 60s and 70s with films like Bonnie and Clyde, where we root for the criminals. Little Big Man, where the Indians are justified for the massacre at Little Bighorn. And To Kill a Mockingbird, where the hero wins his battle through words. He's a lawyer defending a black man. And in that movie, a retarded man saves the little girl. So the definition of the hero is changing. The line blurs between the traditional definition of good guy and bad guy. Ego and shadow are not so clearly demarcated. Independent films tend to be more interesting in this respect, but now even huge commercial blockbusters reflect this. Jake takes over his twin brother's avatar, which is a half-human, half-alien creation, to infiltrate the alien Navi people on Pandora. They have a completely different value system, more feminine, more nature-related. And Jake integrates this other value system by being the avatar on Pandora. He integrates with the help of his anima, with his anima Neytiri, who he falls in love with. He becomes a Navi person.
Right, he becomes her boyfriend, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And she's much taller than him, too, in
In real life.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's 10 feet tall.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
This also reminds me of Dr. Carmen Boulter's work, where she was, her investigation into ancient Egyptian dynasties, and a couple dynasties were matriarch-led, and she describes the connection into the subtle energies of the planet. They were really connected, and they had a depth that would channel these subtle energies through their civilization.
The matriarchal societies and the feminine societies, the feminine-led societies, were different. And cross-culturally, the matriarchal societies preceded the patriarchal societies. All cultures have similar mythologies, actually. But cross-culturally, the matriarchal level of society comes first and then shifts into a patriarchal, after thousands and thousands of years, shifts into a patriarchal level. When that happens, feminine values get lost. And then you might say, well, what are feminine values?
Do these feminine values get interpreted into myths, or are they lost completely?
They are suppressed. They are actually put down. In the book that I wrote, The Cassandra Complex, mm-hmm. It talks about medial intuition in women. And what medial intuition is, it's being a medium, being a receptive vessel for collective impressions. It's being psychic, let's put it that way. It's being psychic. Women tend to be more psychic than men. I mean, it makes sense biologically. They have more water in their body, and water is the medial element. They call it women's intuition.
I've heard that. I've heard women are 10 times more sensitive than men.
Okay. I mean, that's a statement I wouldn't know how to prove or disprove, but that's the conventional wisdom. During matriarchal times, there were priestesses who were prophets. Cassandra was such a being, and that was the book that I wrote. You're talking about this book about developing your psychic skills, and basically the Cassandra complex. It talks about just that thing. My book isn't pop psychology that gives you 10 easy steps to develop your psychic ability. But it talks about the process that a medial woman has to go through in order to be able to use her psychic ability. Women in our culture are disadvantaged because mediality, psychism, it's not valued in our culture. And so from the time that they're little girls, females are trained not to use their psychic abilities, not to use their mediality. Actually, the subtitle of my book is A Jungian Perspective on Hysteria. And I'm correlating medial intuition that is undeveloped with hysteria.
Does undeveloped medial intuition turn into a shadow aspect?
It is a shadow aspect. It's an important shadow aspect of women.
Can you describe that?
Sure. As we define shadow to be something which you have, but you're not aware of it. So medial intuition is not mirrored in the child. And that's how we learn about ourselves, is when the mother or father mirror as us as children. We're hungry, but it requires the mother to come and say, oh, you're hungry, here's the breast. And then we, over time, get to know, oh, that pain in my stomach, that's hunger. I guess I need to go make myself a sandwich. If a little girl knows something, she knows how somebody's feeling, and she says, oh, what's going on? You look upset. And the parent says, I'm not upset. It's leaves the child feeling quite mad, really, because the child is perceiving something and it is not being validated by the outside world. And so that capacity to know things, the capacity to see deeply, the capacity to know past and present and future, is not validated and therefore remains in the shadow. It becomes a shadow problem.
And you've noticed this especially in women.
Yes.
This is really interesting.
I've gotten countless contacts from women saying, wow, thank you for articulating this, because I had no idea that this was what was going on, but it really, your book really describes my experience.
And does it then prompt them to develop that a little further?
If they found the book right there, there's going to be some guidance in how to work with this, because it's a matter of accepting one's medial wisdom. It takes time to do that, but the feminine ego is really quite different from the masculine ego. It's not as boundaried, and to be able to hold a lot of content, especially emotional content, to be able to just hold it and not get afraid of it and not blurt out. That's why they're called hysterics, because women are being filled with the emotions of people all around all the time. And then they express it in a rather illogical way and are accused of being hysterical.
Our guest is Lori Shapira. She's a Jungian analyst in private practice in New York City, a faculty member of the C.G. Jung Institute of New York, and president of the board of directors of the C.G. Jung Institute of New York. She's the author of the book, The Cassandra Complex, Living with Disbelief, and the subtitle, as she mentioned, A Modern Perspective on Hysteria. We started going through down some of these movies. We can hit a couple more if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The big studios seem to be wanting to produce another Batman film. We are looking at some of these blockbuster mainstream movies in terms of the shadow aspect and the unconscious. It seems also that these producers and writers know something about their audience, that they will go to this and watch it again and again and again. What do you think these writers know?
Jeff, I would say that, I mean, it's not just Batman. There's a profusion of these, you know, these Marvel comic book superhero guys. And they appeal, they seem to have quite universal appeal. There's a satisfaction when a regular guy is suddenly imbued with rather super qualities that enable this person to prevail over the evildoers. I mean, this is absolutely a very important dynamic that the male ego goes through. It needs to be able to be strong and prevail. I do believe that these films are exploiting the need for that feeling of being a conquering hero. And they, you know, including all this CGI and, you know, fabulous production values, I find it rather too bad in a way. I don't think it's healthy, because it could even be seen as an addiction, just to feed that need to feel powerful and be able to prevail in a world that is very confusing. There's a lot of dark stuff in our world, and we need to feel like we can, that we're masters of the universe.
That's a really interesting take, Lori. I didn't look at it that way. And
how did you look at it?
I looked at it as the assimilation of the shadow aspects of the hero. Most viewers, male viewers, put themselves into the role. The assimilation of the shadow aspects that create maybe a whole person, but then it connects to what you're saying. That whole person then becomes much stronger and able to conquer and deal with the evil in the world.
Let's go back to the Batman. What's the shadow aspect that's being assimilated?
Well, the two lives of the hero, one in a, who is a regular, acts like a regular person, a wealthy millionaire, multimillionaire, who appears not to have any special strength. And then by putting on the costume, to me it seemed that was the assimilation, or a metaphor for the assimilation.
Okay, so the bat, his bat identity, maybe? I mean, that's because it is a nocturnal animal. It's his hidden side. I see what you mean. I'll go with that.
I also saw it in Spider-Man 3. And,
okay.
You know, after having conversations like this, you'll start to see it.
Right.
In Spider-Man 3, this strange black alien material that came from a meteor attached itself to Spider-Man's suit, and later in the film, he developed some sort of black Spider-Man suit. And when he put that on, he became more attractive to women and assertive, a little more, used violence a little bit more. And he had that nice guy persona that was not attractive to his girlfriend. That same material, black material, also got to a nemesis of Spider-Man's, who was not a superhero, but it transformed him and his shadow aspects, which were more demonic or alien. What it also showed is that it changed from person to person. Everyone's shadow integration is different.
Right, right. That's really true too. I mean, it would be relative to the individual's ego consciousness to begin with, and the Spidey guy, whose name I don't even remember, he was a nice guy. The other guy, his friend, it was his friend, who was not such a nice guy to begin with. So the corruption of the dark matter depends on the host that it latches onto, you know. But certainly you're bringing up another point, which I think is important in this whole issue of shadow integration. And that is that the hero starts off in a rather innocent state, and the confrontation with the shadow actually transforms both, so that the hero becomes wiser, stronger, deeper. He grows up. So the arc of these stories is often, you would be looking for, how does this character of the hero. How does he change by virtue of integrating the shadow?
The Incredible Hulk, the last one, had a similar element in there where there was a nemesis that in conscious life he was a bad person. The real Incredible Hulk in that this particular film was tempered to some degree and hesitant to get angry, and because he knew the consequences. The film showed the different manifestations of the shadow, because the anger is usually a shadow or connecting to some shadow element. So anger was a trigger to become the Hulk. And I just thought, oh, they're showing it again here, what shape the transformation occurs. If you're already sort of an evil person and you integrate the shadow.
Well, it can make you or break you. I mean, it can kill you, or it can corrupt you, or it can make you stronger.
And I suspect that is primarily some of the reasons why this school, the Jungian Institute, exists, to train people to understand this psychological concept, how important it is.
Well, we're training people to become analysts. The goal of the process, which Jung called the individuation process, in which someone becomes who they really are. Now, I mean, this is an impossible goal. It's not something that's really achievable. Really, the operative word is becoming one's true self. But a very important part of the work is the confrontation with the shadow and making that material conscious, finding out that this is part of who you are. It can make you or break you. I mean, my experience is that it seldom breaks one, because people have defenses against integrating material that will be destructive to them. We have psychological reflex resistances if things are getting too hot and heavy. But over the time of the process of the work, one becomes aware of one's shadow, which can be dark or it can be bright. But it's the things that you're not aware are part of you. And the idea of it's becoming whole, really. What the individuation process involves, becoming whole. whole.
If I understand that, it's recognizing that you're an individual, but also part of the billions of people on this planet.
Well, ultimately, that's where it will lead you. But in the beginning, it's more about your own personal shadow. The things that were you were born with. Remember, I talked about the set of cards you're born with, and some of those aspects are not permitted in your family of origin or maybe your culture of origin. Those pieces of you fall into the shadow, and so what tends to come up first in the work are those disenfranchised pieces of shadow pieces.
In your film, The Prophecy of the Seeress, you portray a shadow manifestation of a particular male throughout the ages as a ravenous destroying force. What are you communicating here in terms of the human shadow?
Well, very specifically, there are two characters. There are two plot lines in the film. One is based on an old Norse myth called The Prophecy of the Seeress, in which the father of the gods, Odin, goes to visit the CRS because he knows that the world is coming to an end. There's been a prophecy of Ragnarok, the destruction of the world. And he goes to see the CRS to find out if there's anything that can be done to avoid this fate. Now, both of the plot lines, they're parallel plot lines, and the two characters are both played by the same actors. So the modern plot line is a CEO in Reykjavik, Iceland in 2008, which is when the financial world crisis began, and it started in Iceland. But, you know, the domino effect all over the world. So the CEO lands in his private helicopter and jumps into his Range Rover and drives into Reykjavik to see a tarot card reader for the purpose of finding out if there's anything he can do to avoid financial ruin. Both of the stories interweave with each other. The point being that there's an archetypal story at work here with this, with the global crisis, and that there is a certain kind of personality that has wreaked havoc in the world. The greedy, power-mongering CEO who reflects back to the god Odin in Norse mythology. It's the same psychodynamics at work. In the old Norse myth, the seeress tells Odin, "Nope, too late. You have created your own destruction." The tarot card reader in the modern story is saying the same thing. You've created your own destruction.
Well, Laurie Shapira, you're a Jungian analyst in private practice in New York City and a faculty member of the C.G. Jung Institute of New York, president of the board of directors as well, author of the book, The Cassandra Complex, Living with Disbelief, subtitled A Modern Perspective on Hysteria, and also a filmmaker, and you produced, directed, and written The Prophecy of the Seeress. Thank you so much for being on Another News.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's going to do it for Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m.